Welcome once again to our program, Salvation History. We're on the 25th program talking about the Old Testament, the story of the creation, fall, and the beginning of the redemption of humankind. Our guest, as usual, is Ron Eldred, who teaches religion and history at John Paul II Catholic High. I'm your host, Father Larry Moran, the chaplain down at the Carmelites just at the entrance of Allendale. Ron, we've been covering the mitzvah and the 613 laws, including the Ten Commandments, which they contain, and you were giving us some examples of how it got into so much detail about agricultural matters, what could be planted, what couldn't, some very good things about leaving the gleanings or the leftovers for the poor. Then we talked about the Sabbath day, and of course that became such a conflict between Jesus and the Jewish people, the Pharisees and the like, because it had become so exaggerated what you could do or couldn't do on the Sabbath day. So let's continue to talk a little bit about the Sabbath day, that there's something like 39 general categories of activities forbidden.
Yes, the Jewish rabbis over, you know, the centuries established these 39 general categories of activities forbidden on the Sabbath. And it just mentioned the categories, carrying anything, burning anything, extinguishing anything, finishing, writing, erasing, cooking, washing, sewing, tearing, knotting, untying, shaping, plowing, planting, reaping, harvesting, thrashing, winnowing, selecting anything, sifting, grinding, kneading, combing, spinning, dyeing, chain stitching, warping, weaving, unraveling, building, demolishing anything, trapping anything, shearing anything, slaughtering anything, skinning, tanning, smoothing, and marketing. Those were the 39 categories. Now, that's just the categories. And there were a number of laws that through the 613 mitzvot, or commandments, dealing with each one of these areas. But then on top of that, there were all the interpretations that developed over the centuries. And these were called, I think, the Mishnah, and I think also the Talmud later on. But time you got all these put together, there literally were probably thousands of these. And for a long time, they weren't even written down. I don't think they were written down. In fact, at least a lot of the Mishnah, a lot of the interpretations, weren't even written down by the time of Jesus. If I recall right, I think a lot of these weren't written down until a little bit later, after Jesus. You know, St. Paul, he studied to be a Pharisee. And of course, Pharisee had to learn all these. He was an expert in the law. And he went to the school of Gamaliel in Jerusalem, and he would have had to memorize literally thousands of these, not only the mitzvot, but but all the interpretations, and they had to memorize them. And so he actually was, you know, really quite an expert in the law. No one knew more about the law than he. And when he talked about that pagans, when they became Christians, would not have to practice all those laws, he was not talking about the Ten Commandments. He was talking about those literally hundreds of mitzvot, plus the thousands of interpretations. Some of them, as we pointed out in the last session, got to be rather nitpicking, you know.
Untie a knot, yeah. You could do it with one hand, but otherwise you couldn't untie it. That was work. Well, and Jesus and the Pharisees got into several conflicts, particularly about what you could do or couldn't do on the Sabbath, particularly about healing on the Sabbath.
And of course, that's one of the reasons they hated him as much as anything, because Jesus claimed, and of course he had the authority, but they didn't believe he did, claimed that he had the authority to interpret the law. And that that was their prerogatives, you know, the Pharisees, they thought, and that no other man really had the right to do that. And then, of course, when he makes any kind of claims that he is God, you know, I am before Abraham in one instance, obviously they knew what he was talking about, and that's when they reached to pick up stones and to stone him to death.
Referring to Moses' words out of that came to Moses out of the burning
bush.
That's
correct. Yes, that's how God identified himself as I am.
Well, also, Ron, wasn't the punishment severe for breaking any of these thousands of interpretations?
Well, it certainly was. The penalty for desecrating the Sabbath, under certain circumstances, according to Exodus 31:13-15, was death. The book of Numbers tells the story of a man found gathering wood on the Sabbath day. And he was brought to Moses and Aaron and the whole assembly, and they kept him in custody because they weren't sure what to do with him. But God said that the man must die, so the Israelites stoned him to death outside the camp. I believe that later the death penalty was lessened to cutting a person off, you know, from the rest of the community, or shunning them, you know, and not the death penalty. But you know, they got to be rather severe.
Now, of course, because there were so many, it was hard to even know. A lot of people just gave up trying to follow them.
And I would say that 99 times out of 100, people got by with it. You know, they didn't necessarily have a police force that was out watching, you know, everybody's behavior, you know, out in the countryside or in their homes or this, that, and the other. And most people probably... And the Pharisees had a tendency to really look down on anybody, of course, especially the lower classes, because the lower classes of people had a tendency not to sometimes practice all those things.
Probably didn't even know them.
They didn't even know them, yes. Yeah. They
wouldn't. Well, and Jesus kept saying, you put burdens on men's back that they are unable to bear, and you won't lift a finger to help them carry the burdens. So it was a major source. And we can see why in some of these laws that were just impossible to even keep track of, much less to keep. Well, Ron, what about the laws dealing with marriage and divorce? Because by the time Jesus came, divorce was rather common.
Yes, this was the third category of the mitzvot. I'll name a few of these. One would be to marry a wife by means of ketubah, or Jewish or prenuptial agreement. That was just an agreement. Not to withhold food, clothing, and sexual relations from your wife. To have children with one's wife. I have the biblical reference for each one of these.
Sure, well, that'd be Genesis 1:28.
Yes. To issue a divorce by means of a get or divorce document. That's found in Deuteronomy 24:1. A man must not remarry his ex-wife after she has married someone else. To perform yibum, that is, marry the widow of one's childless brother, that was a requirement.
To raise children to the brother's name.
Yes. Well, you know, if a man died and he had a wife, there may not be anybody to take care of her. So there was some practical reasons for that. And that's something that was practiced not only by the Jews, but I think was something very common in that part of the world back then. You might recall there was one of Jesus' questions that they asked him about. This woman had been married supposedly seven times, I think it was, and which one would she have in heaven to be her husband? And Jesus said the Pharisees, or whoever was asking the questions, didn't really understand this whole issue.
But there's no...
Of course, he also said that when they asked him about a bill of divorce, and Jesus, you might recall, said, well, because of your weakness, Moses allowed this. And that you find that in Deuteronomy. And there are a lot of places in Deuteronomy that sort of lessen or mitigate the commandments that you find in Leviticus. And he said, because of the hardness of your hearts or your weaknesses of this, that, the other, he permitted
but
divorce.
But it would not be anymore since he had come.
Yes, but he says, well, this is not the way it was in the beginning. And, of course, he reestablished. So that's one of the reasons they were so critical of him, because he seemed to be changing the law, what had been permitted in many instances.
And made it harder.
Yes. In some instances he made it easier, but in a lot of instances, some instances he made it much more difficult.
Like the matter of divorce.
A widow, she must not remarry until the ties with her brother-in-law are removed. A court must fine one who sexually seduces a maiden. A rapist must marry the maiden. He's never allowed to divorce her. The slanderer must remain married to his wife. In other words, he can't divorce her. And there are many, many, many others. I mean, there's probably another 100 that have to do, you know, with these kind of, family marital issues.
But at least there was plenty of ability to get a divorce. And that's what brought up to Jesus, that Moses allowed us to get a divorce. And by that time, it was for any reason.
Well, we know when you go back into the time of Moses, the Jews practiced polygamy. A lot of the Jews had, the patriarchs, of course, all had more than one wife. And this was very widely practiced, not only among the Jews, but also among almost all the people in the Middle East at that time. I read something the other day, though, that even during the time of Christ, that a man was allowed up to four wives. I'd have to, go and really verify that. But in other words, if that's true, polygamy continued to be practiced among the Jews even up until the time of Christ.
Okay, and that may be one of the hardest things that Jesus said.
Oh, yes.
To restore it as it was in the beginning.
Yes.
Okay, well, what about civil law and criminal law? That'd be the fourth category. We got agricultural laws, we've got sabbatical laws, we got marriage laws and divorce. What about civil and criminal law?
Well, within that fourth category, there were just, maybe a couple of hundred. I'm not sure. There were an awfully lot of them. The buying and selling of property, there were a lot that had to do with that. The forgiving of debts, weights and measures. Quite a few laws dealing with that, borrowing and lending, how slaves were to be treated, making war, what would be the conditions under which a war could be, made, the system of courts that the Jewish people were to have, the punishments for various crimes, such as how to deal with idolaters or those who engage in different types of superstitious behavior. Those were some of the categories that had to do with civil and criminal matters and their legal matters.
Well, what about the fifth category, Ron, about ritual or liturgical laws or what happened going on in the temple and services?
Well, there were many laws in the mitzvot that pertained to sacrificing animals and produce. For example, only unblemished animals could be offered for sacrifice, meaning that they must be healthy and having had no broken bones. Now, we know that has significance, of course, when Jesus was crucified. And the reason, of course, they didn't break his bones so that he would die more quickly, of course, he was already dead, and that's why they didn't do it, was because he was to be like the Passover lamb. And, of course, the Passover lamb had to be unblemished. That means he couldn't have been sick. Any kind of sickness during his life, couldn't have any broken bones, couldn't have any deformity or anything of that sort. Not to dedicate a blemished animal for the altar. Not to slaughter it. Not to sprinkle its blood. Not to burn its fat. Not to offer a temporarily blemished animal. Not to sacrifice blemished animals, even if offered by non-Jews. Not to inflict wounds upon dedicated animals. To offer only animals which are at least 8 days old. Not to offer animals brought with the wages of a harlot or the animal exchange for a dog. Not to burn honey or yeast on the altar. To salt all sacrifices. Not to omit the salt from sacrifices. Carrying out the procedure of the burnt offering as prescribed by the Torah. Not to eat its meat. Carry out the procedure of the sin offering, not to eat the meat of an inner sin offering, not to decapitate a fowl brought as a sin offering. You know, they would sacrifice doves and pigeons, if I recall right. In fact, that plays a role, of course, during the life of Jesus, especially at the presentation.
offered the two doves of the poor offering.
Yeah, because they were too poor to buy a lamb, yes. Carry out the procedure of the guilt offering. And I'm just going to skip down through here. I have a rather long list. To offer all sacrifices in the temple. That's an important one. To offer all sacrifices in the temple. This is found in Deuteronomy 12:11. Jews were not allowed to offer sacrifices anywhere else except in the temple. And they get themselves...
In Jerusalem.
And they get themselves in trouble time and time and time and time again. That was one of the things, as you'll see, as we go through the time of David and Solomon and the kings, the many kings that followed after that time, how they allowed sacrifices in areas other than in the temple. And this is one of the things that the prophets would warn them about when they would come. It was customary to offer sacrifices up in the high places or in groves. These were considered to be sacred places, you know, by the pagans. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but in Samaria, we'll get into that issue later on, they had their own temple there for a while. And that was considered to be illegal, of course, by the Jews. One of the reasons that they hated the Samaritans so much, but there were half a dozen other reasons, too, that we'll come to much later in the series. The rest of them have to do, you know, of slaughtering lambs and when to light the fire and when to extinguish the fire and remove the ashes and all that kind of thing. To burn incense every day, that comes into the fore. You know, might recall in the story of Zechariah, Elizabeth's husband. You remember, that's what, when he went into the outer room, he went into the holy room, not the Holy of Holies behind the curtain. And only the high priest was allowed to go into once a year at Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. He enters into the outer room, by lot. He was chosen to go in there and light the altar of incense. And, of course, that's when Gabriel appears to him and gives him, you know, his message about him and Elizabeth going to have a son, John the Baptist.
Okay, so it gets really detailed from what you're saying, obviously. Could we talk about the one about ritual purity and impurity, which was so important that caused conflict again? Jesus didn't follow many of the ritual purification.
Didn't wash your hands before a meal or something of this sort. There's a practical, you know, hygienic reason for doing that. Mm-hmm. But also there's a ritualistic reason for doing that too. And that have nothing to do with, you know, actual cleanliness and health and what have you. There's a large number of mitzvot laws that apply to ritual purity and impurity. And in fact, it seems at times to be the most important part of the law.
Mm.
Traditional Judaism requires certain types of ritual washing. For example, ritual washing the hands when getting up in the morning, after a night's sleep, or even after a lengthy nap. There is the custom to wash one's hands ritually by pouring a large cup of water over one's fingers, alternating three times. Well, that's really getting ritualistic, you see. But see, this is something that was in the mitzvot. So, you know, a Jew really had to do this. Maybe it wasn't necessary when you get up from a nap to go wash your hands, and let alone wash it in this exact way.
Right.
But again, these were things that the Jews had to do to set themselves apart. And the reason they had to do these things was because of their sin at Mount Sinai, more than anything else, is why God imposed all these extra things on the Jewish people. We might say really burdens in a sense.
We would have something similar as Catholics when we come into church, put our hand in holy water, blessed water, and make the sign of the cross to remind us of our baptism. It has nothing to do with hygiene. It's a matter of a spiritual reminder, a spiritual purification.
Well, another one would be ritually washing the hands and giving a blessing before eating bread. Well, of course, this is something that we do as Catholics as well. Ritually washing the hands without a blessing after touching something ritually impure, such as one's private parts, leather shoes, or an insect or an animal, or after paying a visit to a cemetery. ritually washing the hands after a meal to protect oneself from touching the eyes with hazardous material. Ritually washing the hands after a Passover Seder, that is, you know, the Seder Supper. Ritually washing the hands after having gone to the bathroom. Well, that's certainly has a very practical hygienic purpose to it. Ritually washing the hands of every high priest by a Levite before giving a priestly blessing in front of the congregation. Well, you know, in the Catholic Church, during our liturgies, we have some ritual washings at various times that symbolize things.
Mm-hmm.
There has nothing to do as such with hygiene. Ritually washing the hands to remove impurities after cutting one's hair or nails. And one more, ritually washing the hands to remove after participating in a funeral procession, entering a cemetery, or coming within a few feet of a corpse. That was one thing they really had a bugaboo about, was being around the dead.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of the Jewish laws, if I remember right, is that the dead person had to be buried by nightfall. They couldn't keep them around, you know, several days and go through the whole embalming process like we do, that they had to be buried. I don't know. I think Orthodox Jews probably would still adhere to that, maybe even conservative Jews. I doubt very much if Reformed Jews did, unless it's just a matter of sentiment or
tradition
or something of that sort.
Well, so some of these make good sense in terms of hygiene. Others are just really a ritual law, and washing it with from my hip of my fingers down to my wrist, and then rewashing them from my wrist down to my hand, certain ways to do it, became really not, it wasn't hygienic, it was more ritualistic, and became something very critically important, why the Pharisees always attacked Jesus and his disciples about not keeping the ritual laws. Well, weren't there some laws that demanded full immersion in a special body of water?
Yes, there was. There are certain activities that require this complete immersion in a spring or a stream or a mikvah. I understand that a mikvah was a stone bathtub-like structure that reminds me of some of the baptismal pools built in some new Catholic churches. And the water in the pools must accumulate there by some form of natural flow of water, such as a spring or well or naturally occurring water in some way or another. Examples that required full immersion in the mikvah included by a married woman, a married Jewish woman, after her menstruation period or after a uterine bleeding of any kind, on the eve of Yom Kippur and other festivals, that would be men and women, when converting to Judaism, it's sort of like almost like a baptism, I guess you could say. The ritual washing and cleansing and immersion in a mikvah according to some customs of a Jew's body prior to burial. After contact with a corpse or a grave by Jewish priest when they are being consecrated. For skin conditions such as psoriasis. After normal discharge of any kind of body fluids. Ritual purification after a childbirth. This one was very important because this is what Mary's purification was all about. You know, when they went into the temple and Jesus was presented to the temple, Mary also underwent one of these ritual purifications. And this would mean, of course, that she would have to go down into one of these,
stone
bathtub type thing and undergo this ritual purification. Now, Mary, of course, really didn't need to do this because she had a miraculous birth, but that's a story we'll reserve when we get to the New Testament.
Okay, well, weren't many of the mitzvah laws concerning food that the Israelites were allowed to eat? That's a very complicated thing.
Yes, these were laws describing how to distinguish between kosher and non-kosher fowl, fish, insects, and animals. And kosher means food fit for consumption by Jews according to the Torah. Aside from some obvious reasons of health, the reason for not eating certain foods is not clear. For example, dietary laws are based on verses in the Bible, in the book of Exodus, which forbids boiling a kid, that is a goat, in its mother's milk. And it appears again in the book of Deuteronomy. Okay. These verses and others are the basis for these distinct dietary laws. And I'll give you a few examples here. The prohibition against cooking a mixture of meat and milk. The prohibition against eating a cooked mixture of milk and meat. The prohibition against deriving any benefit from cooking from cooked mixture of milk and meat. There seem to be quite a few of that type. I'll skip down through here. Not to eat non-kosher flying insects.
Mm.
Well, of course, you know, a lot of societies, they eat insects a lot, especially locusts.
Grasshoppers.
Yeah, and grasshoppers, yes. And worms of various kinds, especially grub-type worms. And not to eat non-kosher creatures that crawl on land. Not to eat non-kosher maggots. Not to eat worms found in fruit on the ground. Not to eat creatures that live in water other than fish. In other words, salamanders and all those kind of things were not permissible.
Mm.
Or frogs, probably. Not to eat the meat of an animal that died without ritual slaughter. Not to benefit from an ox condemned to be stoned. Not to eat meat of an animal that was mortally wounded. Not to eat a limb torn off a living creature. Not to eat blood. They were especially very much against eating blood. And the reason was is because blood was the symbol of life. It was believed that that was the life. And so if you ate the blood, either in the meat that wasn't properly drained, or you would drink the blood like some societies do, or use it for other dishes or whatever, that you would be taking on the animal's characteristics, perhaps, you know, because that was the soul, basically, of the animal.
Okay.
Not to eat, well, I'll skip over these. Not to cook and eat, some of those. Not to eat untithed fruits, to ritually slaughter an animal before eating it, not to slaughter an animal and its offspring on the same day, to cover the blood of a shepherd's beast or fowl with earth, to send away the mother bird before taking its children. Those are just a lot of them, you know, really don't make a whole lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, are there other categories of Jewish law contained in the mitzvot that you would like to mention before we go on to another topic? And I think the reason that you're wanting to cover this is because it shows up in Jesus' relation with the scribes and the Pharisees and the leaders of the Jewish people.
And I think it also tells us what St. Paul means when he's saying that you don't have to adhere to the law.
Be free from the burden of the law.
For example, men must not shave the hair off the sides of their head. Men must not shave their beards with a razor. Men must not wear women's clothing. Women must not wear men's clothing. Not to tattoo the skin, not to tear the skin in mourning, not to make a bald spot in mourning, and those kinds of things. So those were some other type of areas.
Okay, we're down to a minute. You want to comment why the Israelites had so many of these commandments, hundreds and even thousands of interpretations?
Well, they were God's chosen people, and however unworthy they might prove to be over the centuries, a people to whom he revealed himself and which he prepared the way for the Messiah. So therefore they had to be set apart from all the pagans that surrounded them.
Okay, well, I think we're going to close with that, Ron. Our time has run out. Thanks again. And to our listening audience, we say may God bless you all, always, and in all ways.